a result of the revolution. A spokesman for the Yemeni military said that this year's parade is a warning to the Saudi-led coalition to end the war and stop its aggression.
We are awaiting the orders of Sayed Abdel Malik to take our positions on the military fronts in order to liberate our lands from every foreign invader.
A UN-backed ceasefire was signed back in April to end hostilities and pave the way for peaceful dialogue. Despite this, the Saudi government continues to impose an economic blockade on its impoverished neighbor. The kingdom's actions are also jeopardizing efforts for peace.
The ceasefire agreement is set to expire on October 2nd, and if not extended, could lead to the resumption of war. The Ansar Allah leader has already said that the Yemeni army and allied fighters are prepared for any scenario. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi wrapped up his first appearance at the United Nations General Assembly with a question-and-answer session with Western media. A range of subjects were covered. Raisi said that Iran's recent admittance to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will be mutually beneficial for all members. In reference to the anti-Iran terror group, the MKO, he rhetorically asked the West, "Why do you keep chanting slogans about fighting against terrorism while housing, giving support, and giving safe haven to them?" He demanded that all Palestinians finally be allowed to vote in referendums and in a transparent manner to decide their fate. Regarding the JCPOA, Raisi emphasized, "The important issue that matters today is sanctions relief." He continued, "Iran's need for guarantees is due to the bitter experience of America's prior noncompliance with the accord. The only side that kept living up to their side of the bargain was the Islamic Republic of Iran." While on the election campaign last year, one of Raisi's key themes was the idea that the world is not just the West.
"Our foreign policy is based on engagement with everyone, Eastern as well as Western. The previous administration targeted the West a bit more, but now we have adopted a more balanced approach. Any country which wants to have engagement with us, we will certainly pave the way to work with them, and with a priority to our neighboring countries."
Raisi's first speech at the United Nations seemed to fall on deaf ears in much of the Western media, even though it was full of progressive political ideals, such as the duty to help neighboring countries in hardship, the total refusal to obtain nuclear weapons, and the rejection of capitalism over morality.
"Arrogance. Some countries see themselves as more than or superior to others, perhaps because of their financial or military capabilities, and this is a true cause of oppression."
Many believe that few countries are as unobjectively and negatively portrayed by the Western mainstream media as Iran. Raisi's press conference was a chance for Western reporters to consider the Iranian view. Many hope their coverage will be more balanced in the future. Ramin Mazahari, New York City.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
"There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same."
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the US certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
They think they can do the same thing here what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades and never had any issues whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along and they've caused so much grief here. And most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, Presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is his right, since him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Protests in Iran have now had a counter-protest in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. Countrywide anti-riot and pro-government protests were held, much bigger than what was held on Friday. Iranians condemned the rioters to have assaulted religious sanctities like mosques. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the destructive role that foreign countries have played, including their social media tactics, and how Iranian authorities and people will not fall victim to their strategies, which for the most part have the goal of regime change in mind. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Masoud Shajara joins us. He's a political analyst from London. Also joining us, Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener. Welcome to you both. I will first start with you, Masoud Shajara. We've looked at these countrywide demonstrations that took place today, which were in the hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions, as I just indicated, including in the capital, Tehran, really a breath of fresh air when we take a look at the scenes for the past nights of just vandalism and riots. and the destruction of property. Your initial thoughts on the huge turnout today?
It really is very telling how ordinary people have come out and sort of demonstrating against what has been very clearly misuse of the issue by a group of people, and turning the what is very tragic death of a very young woman into a sort of regime change campaign. And I think the real reason why so many people have come out today is exactly that. They are recognizing that there is a misuse and abuse of sentiment of ordinary people regarding this young woman and what is the family are going through, and how they are sort of misusing this whole process for their political end. And it's been directed, wooed, and supported by the West and Israel and everything else. The evidence is very clear, and it's very unfortunate, because I think the issue is a very important issue. As Mr. Raisi, in his phone call with the father of this young woman, indicated that there has to be a proper investigation, and he actually promised a proper investigation. And indeed, even the father of this young woman have actually complained and disassociated himself and the family from this sort of misuse and abuse of what the family is going through. And I think this is really very important for ordinary people to come out and sort of oppose this sort of barbaric actions that have been taken by a minority of people trying to undermine the emotional feeling of many, both inside Iran and outside, for what this family is going through currently.
Indeed. Well, when we want to take a look at the way that these protests have turned out, Robert Fantina, obviously you had an unfortunate incident that happened. So that's our starting point. And then you have the news that's been all over the place in the media covered, whether it's inside Iran or outside. And then you have a protest that began. But we noticed how quickly those protests actually were then led to the destruction of property, which wasn't even really... You see, you can't... If a stone is thrown at a store, it's one thing. But when you have mosques that are being burnt and destroyed, or when you have ambulances that are being destroyed in the dozens, or security forces to be attacked, police stations to be attacked, it's a far cry from just regular protest. At least that's what logic dictates, which then obviously analysts like yourself need to be asked, what happened? How did it get to that point?
That's a very good question, because as you mentioned, legitimate protest is valid anywhere. Peaceful people peacefully protesting government policy that they don't like, that's their right anywhere. But when they are damaging or destroying mosques, when they are damaging and destroying emergency vehicles, ambulances, and so on, this is not protest. This is coming from some other source. Now, the United States, of course, has for years wanted regime change in Iran. It's done everything it can do to...
Go ahead. You just cut off for a second. Go ahead, if you can just repeat what you said.
Okay, yeah. Sure. The United States has for years wanted regime change in Iran. It's done everything it could to foster that. So one might look at these protests and see where the source of them is. Certainly, people are angry about what happened to this poor young woman, but there is a way of demonstrating their anger that does not include violence. However, the United States is a nation that believes in violence, that believes that that's the way of getting things done. This is evidenced by its many wars and aggressions throughout the world. The United States has covert agents operating in many countries, and certainly in Iran. So it wouldn't be too unusual or far-fetched to say that some of this violence is being encouraged and fostered and started by the United States.
Okay, we're going to get into that in a minute. The questions that come up, Masoud Shajar, looking at the videos and the incidents that have happened. There's a very important perspective to look at these protests, where these questions come up, where Western media are looking at this in a different light, as vulgar and as violent as some of the incidents that I'm going to cite right now, where you have these so-called protesters actually hurting other civilians. They're slitting the throats of police officers. They're knifing people. They're vandalizing public property, or they're carrying weapons, ammunition, and even explosives. You see, that aspect of it doesn't sound like these are regular protesters.
Absolutely, and the sort of incompetent, or it's not even incompetent, and the sort of coercion of the Western media, it really is unbelievable. This actually proves what we've been saying for a very long time, that fair reporting and unbiased reporting, it's something that is only an illusion. What is left of it is an illusion that it happens. It doesn't happen. We had a side panel at the UN 3 days ago with Professor David Miller going over how Islamophobic, how biased the media is. And, you know, this is not, unfortunately, something new. It's not just happening in Iran. Right now, yesterday, in Britain, in Trafalgar Square, these protesters were shouting, long live Israel, Iran Republic. I mean, what does long live Israel has got to do with the unfortunate death of a young woman? And today, they actually attacked a Arba'in procession in Hyde Park, injuring many people. And right now, from what I've been told, just come before coming on air, and they have gathered outside the mosque in Maida Vale, and they're throwing a stone at their broken windows. So it's not, they're not just bringing destruction and barbarism in Iran and in Tehran. In London, they're implementing and doing the same policy. This has got nothing to do whatsoever. A group of people, most of them, overwhelming majority of them, not Iranian, going on a procession for Arba'in, it's got nothing to do with the unfortunate death of a young woman in Iran. And but this is what this has become. It really has got no relation whatsoever with the unfortunate situation. This, it seems that there were a whole group of people organized and just waiting for the right time to come out and actually create chaos and death and destruction.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the things that I failed to mention here is we have had deaths. We've had over 40 deaths as far as records go. And this is something that the government itself has announced. So when you're looking at the deaths, then we need to take a look at the foreign hands that are at play over here. Robert Fantina, we are looking at elements of Daesh terrorist group that have been cited. We're looking at some other groups also, such as maybe MKO terrorists and their elements to be involved in these protests, because we know that there's a history and track record that they have had in this country, obviously. And also a group, the Kamala group, a left-wing Kurdish group, and maybe other foreign-backed groups that are have I'm going to use the word infiltrated these protests. Again, the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says Iranians have a right to protest. But when you have these types of elements to have infiltrated these protesters and the protests themselves, then it becomes a different story. Why do you think there's been a convergence of these groups into these protests? Why do they feel that they have to come into this and create the havoc that they have?
Groups like MKO have very little presence in Iran generally because the people of Iran don't like them. They don't support them. They don't, as you mentioned, they have the right to do. These groups will try to hijack those demonstrations in an attempt to show that, oh, the people are dissatisfied. They want regime change. Now, as I mentioned before, the United States is always calling for regime change in Iran and is saying that these demonstrations are symbolic or indicative of that desire by the Iranian people. However, we have to remember that 2 years ago, there were demonstrations across the country in the United States. the United States government didn't at that time say, oh, the people want regime change. People were simply demonstrating and protesting against police brutality and racism. Yet when they're another country that the United States, for whatever reason, has determined as an enemy, sees demonstrations against some government policy, the United States is ready to say, oh, see, the people want regime change. This is not what the people want. These groups, Daesh, MKO, and others, are simply hijacking what was probably beginning as a peaceful demonstration.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we just got cut off at the end there due to the bad connection. But we got your point, so we're going to move on here, and let's talk about the MKO, or the MEK terrorist cult, as it's called. And there was an interesting statement to bring up right now, which still rings true, Masoud Shajar, and that's what the former Iranian foreign minister actually said. I think it was a couple of years back when this news came out, maybe earlier than that, where he slammed Twitter for blocking social media accounts of real Iranians while overlooking social media influence operations that came at that point from actual bots in Tirana, which was a reference to the group's complex at the Albanian capital, where they conducted relentless online information campaigns. So this opens up the door for your analysis into that and then the social media aspect of this, of how this is being driven by foreign powers. Give us what you think about that.
Well, first of all, social media says that they are committed against violence, against those who promote violence, those who promote divisions in the society and so forth. And the reality is that all those so-called wonderful sentiments have been sort of chucked away when it comes to Iran and MKO and indeed other groups who have been organized manipulating social media, asking and promoting violence, and they're actually booing people. They're guiding people and encouraging people to commit acts of the violence. And nothing being done by the social media and so forth. The other aspect is, as my colleague said, the MKO and MEK have got no support whatsoever in Iran. People have been on the receiving end of their commitment to atrocities against ordinary innocent citizens, and the statistic for that is very clear and very telling. The only reason that the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia are supporting and financing and promoting and protecting MKO is because they are, first of all, they have got an infrastructure that could be mobilized for this sort of type of thing, and their willingness to kill ordinary innocent people. They've got no morals, as any sort of other terrorist organization will have. As long as they are paid the right amount of money and supported, they will commit any acts of terrorism against the Iranians, as they show what they did in support of Saddam, killing ordinary Iranians and being a traitor by any standard. So the value in supporting MKO, MEK by United States, West, and indeed Israel and Saudi Arabia is that nothing to do whatsoever with any sort of popularity, as they are the most unpopular group within Iran. So this is a sort of unholy marriage between a terrorist group, which have even killed American citizens in past, and is willing to kill for money and for survival. And that is the reason it's being supported. It is outrageous that the social media, with all their commitments to good practices, when it comes to Iran, they actually abandon all that.
Well, you know what's incredible is back in 2019, there was an interesting revelation that was made, not to get into the MKO deal here too much, Robert Fantina, but it's quite incredible when it came out that an Iranian activist wrote dozens of articles for right-wing outlets in the U.S., and then it turns out that this writer by the name of Heshmat Alavi, which was pushing for regime change in Iran, which was in charge of social media accounts and its operation to penetrate inside Iranians' minds, basically, turned out to be no one. He didn't exist. And he was quoted by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. So the depth that the U.S. is involved here, which you have mentioned on a couple occasions here, Robert Fantina, of this push for regime change, it kind of falls in the lines of it's tired. It's a tired move. The maximum pressure campaign kind of falls with the regime change interchangeably. But it is quite important that they are doing this continuously. Even Anthony Blinken coming out saying we're not going to make the mistake that Obama did and pushing support for this in indirect ways. Why do you think they follow this failed policy when it comes to Iran, which today showed that it will definitely fail based on the numbers that came out protesting?
The United States government leaders have never understood the people of Iran's support for the Iranian government. Because the government is structured in a different way than the U.S. government, the U.S. government officials think it's invalid and that no one could want it. They forget the fact that in 1978, 1979, people overthrew the U.S. Puppet government in Iran and established a government that's only if the decisions they make are pleasing to the U.S. government. And the government, the Iranian revolution was not pleasing to the U.S. government, so they have fought it ever since. As far as why they continue with this failed policy, part of it is simply political. They don't want to be seen as being weak and sometimes it's communism, that's not an issue in Iran. They don't want to be seen weak on anyone that they have determined is an enemy to the United States. So they have determined with complete invalidity or with no validity whatsoever that Iran is a threat, and they've convinced many of the members of the U.S. public that that's the case. And by continuing to foster regime change activities, sanctions, and so on, they're showing their constituents that they're strong against this imagined threat. And the only thing that's important to government officials is their reelection, and they think this is a way of accomplishing that.
You're there in London, Master Shajara, and we had the Tehran summoning the British ambassador to protest the role of the London-based Persian language media outlet there, which I'm sure you know the name, which is government-run, which is short, basically, of the way they're covering it. It's just short of saying, here's a handbook that we're going to read out loud of how you should carry and incite violence. These are the steps to do it, really. So my question is, where is Ofcom? What happened to Ofcom? You say something about Palestinians in the wrong way that rubs Israel the wrong way, and Ofcom jumps in and gives you a warning. Where are they?
Yeah, it really is outrageous. I mean, also, I'm sure you and the viewers know that particular channel is a government channel, and the foreign section world service of it, which what we are talking about, is actually financed directly by the Foreign Office. So it is politically sort of controlled. But you will not see on Twitter or anywhere else any warning that this is a sort of a government-run outfit. And you're right. It is outrageous. It's really totally unacceptable. But I think I'd like to actually say something else here as well. You know, we're talking about regime change. Regime change itself is illegal and unacceptable. There's no business of anyone trying to actually change a government anywhere else. You know, if you try to do that in the United States or even interfere in the election, there will be such a huge outcry, rightly so. But here, we're not even talking about regime change in a way that they change the current government in Iran into a democratic government or, you know, any sort of acceptable government. What they're trying to do is to repeat what they did to Libya, to Syria, to Iraq, to Afghanistan, totally destroy the whole of infrastructure and create such a chaos that the only thing will flourish will be extreme sort of terrorist activity like Daesh and so forth. And that is what their plan is. And people who came out today in Iran, they understand this. They understand that this interference has got nothing to do with wishing them a better future in whatever shape or politics. It really is to destroy the infrastructure, to put back Iran 100 years exactly what they've done in Libya and what the Libyans are facing right now. And that is what Iranians don't want. And that's why they come out and they say, no interference in our affairs. Keep your hands off Iran.
We could cite so many examples, Robert Fatina, about the double standards that are applied over here. And, of course, the interference overall that Iran really condemns, and they have every right to do that. But I'm going to add to those examples. In no shape or form am I saying two wrongs make a right. But when we talk about the fact that a woman at this point lost her life here, what about what happened to Shireen Abu Akleh? She was a woman. She was killed and assassinated in cold blood. The U.S. came out and said convincingly that this was not something that was done on purpose. And here we are. There's no word really on that except here and there. Or when we had the other day, earlier this week actually, we had a 15-year-old Iraqi high school girl, Zainab Assam al-Khazali, who was killed in broad daylight by American troops. It was during a military drill. But you don't see what's efforts are being put as it is on Iran as to these two incidents. So in that case in point, again, is it because the issue of Iran, topic of Iran, is that sensitive because they want to obtain their political goals at the end, which is what you have said?
That's certainly part of it. The U.S. wants to obtain its geopolitical goals, goals that it has for its the world order that it sees. That would benefit it, only not benefit the people of the United States, but benefit the wealthy and the leaders of the United States. That's all they're really interested in. With the situation with Shireen Abu Akleh, this was an assassination. Independent media outlets in the United States have said this was a targeted assassination. The United States government will not confirm that, will not agree with that. The United States will do it sees is best for the leadership and the wealth of the United States. The killing of this young Iraqi girl, okay, which is horrific, these things happen at military bases around, U.S. military bases around the world. The amount of damage, the pollution, the amount of crimes that these soldiers commit is shocking.
Okay.
But the United States has agreements that exclude it from accountability.
Thank you very much for that. We're fresh out of time. Robert Fatina there, author and journalist from Kitchener. Masoud Shajara, thank you so much. Political analyst from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Takway and the team. It's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. A new version of the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines published by the U.S. government doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. We'll prepare for you an article written by Marina Bolotnikova. The piece is titled, How U.S. Government Diet Guidelines Ignore the Climate Crisis. To keep the climate habitable, most scientists agree that switching to renewable energy alone isn't enough. Americans also need to change the way they eat. Environmental and public health advocates are pushing a new strategy to help get there, including climate breakdown in the official U.S. dietary guidelines, which shape what goes into billions of meals eaten across the country every year. Every 5 years, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services jointly publish a new version of the guidelines. They form the basis for a public-facing eating guide, My Plate, formerly My Pyramid, as well as many government-backed meal programs such as National School Lunch. Historically, these guidelines have narrowly focused on human nutrition, but some are now saying they should be expanded to incorporate climate considerations as well. The current 150-page edition for 2020 through to 2025 doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. The recently passed Inflation Reduction Act, the so-called most significant climate legislation in U.S. history, does very little to address the food system. Jesse Silverman, a senior policy associate for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, said, "Climate change poses a multitude of threats to human health and nutrition security. We cannot extricate these things from each other." Her group and 39 others, including the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Academy of Pediatrics, in May, wrote a letter urging the U.S. government to include sustainability in the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines, which are now in development. A sustainability component would encourage Americans to eat less meat and dairy products, which have a significant higher climate impact than nutritionally comparable plant-based foods. Another signatory to the letter, Mark Rifkin, senior food and agriculture policy specialist for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, "It will be virtually impossible to even meet the 2 degrees Celsius limit in global temperature change without incorporating substantial reductions in beef intake." Walter Willett, a professor at Harvard University's School of Public Health, said the current guidelines advise Americans to eat far more animal products than is sustainable. The primary dietary chart recommends 26 ounces of protein from meat, poultry, and eggs a week, compared with just 5 ounces from plant-based foods, although there are alternative charts that show how vegetarians can get the same nutrients without meat. He said they also still basically say 3 servings of dairy products a day, which is actually really radical because our current consumption is 1.6 servings a day, adding, "To just recommend 3 servings of dairy products and say nothing about the environmental consequences if people really did that, it's just completely irresponsible. Because most Americans are deficient in fiber and fruits and vegetables, not animal products," Mark Rifkin, a dietitian, said, "climate-focused guidance would line up with what the public needs nutritionally." He said it would also help address other problems that stem from the meat-heavy U.S. food system, including risk of future pandemics, food security, and pollution from concentrated animal feeding operations, which disproportionately affect communities of color. A proposed list of questions released in April for the scientific panel that advises the guidelines didn't include sustainability. That worries advocates, but they say it's still early. Janet De Jesus, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services staff lead on the guidelines, said sustainability could still be included. De Jesus said, "We're not saying that it's not going to be in the dietary guidelines. We're not saying that at all." She added, "It's a high priority for the Health and Human Services leadership to address climate change." According to a United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization FAO report, countries including Germany, Brazil, Sweden and Qatar have addressed sustainability in their dietary guidelines. Canada's Food Guide advises choosing plant-based foods more often for the environment. Vox reported recently Germany has cut its per capita meat consumption by 12% since 2011, and its Minister of Food and Agriculture has recently prioritized a shift towards more plant-based eating. Advocates say a change in the U.S. dietary guidelines could have a similar influence. Jesse Silverman says, "The guidelines are much more impactful than I think a lot of people realize. Federal food aid programs have to comply with the guidelines, shaping how millions of people eat. For instance, the National School Lunch and National School Breakfast programs claim they served more than 7 billion meals a year to tens of millions of children before the COVID-19 pandemic. The guidelines also influence cafeteria foods served in government buildings, hospitals and other institutions, and are used in nutrition education programs. According to a recent paper in Communications, Earth and Environment, national school lunches reach makes it uniquely positioned to affect the dietary patterns of American children and adolescents and could aid in addressing the environmental impacts of food systems. Meat contributes disproportionately to school meals' impact on the climate, as well as land and water use. Because U.S. government programs and other large institutions claim they serve so many meals, sustainability advocates in recent years have focused on trying to influence their food buying decisions. California earlier this year allowed $100 million to help schools serve more plant-based meals. This isn't the first time the environment has been at issue in the nation's dietary guidelines. In 2015, a panel of nutrition experts that advised the 2015 through to 2020 guidelines addressed sustainability in its scientific report. The panel wrote, "In general, a dietary pattern that is higher in plant-based foods such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in animal-based foods is more healthy and it should be promoted and is associated with lesser environmental impact. But after outcry from the meat industry and U.S. Republican lawmakers, the recommendation to eat more plants was dropped from the final guidelines. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal at the time, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said sustainability was outside the purview of the dietary guidelines and compared the scientific committee to his granddaughter, whose colors outside of the lines. Bob Martin of the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future said about Tom Vilsack's comments, "It's really condescending stuff. The people involved in this were highly qualified." Agribusiness has a long history of influence over the dietary guidelines, and it will undoubtedly be a factor this time around as well. The meat and dairy industries spent $49.5 million on political contributions in 2020 and another $15.9 million lobbying the federal government. Food industry groups also routinely report lobbying on federal nutrition policy. According to federal lobbying records, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association between 2014 and 2016 spent more than $303,000 lobbying to keep beef in the dietary guidelines. Several industry groups, including the North American Meat Institute, the National Dairy Foods Association, and the National Turkey Federation, have already weighed in on the process for the 2025 through to 2030 guidance. The National Pork Producers Council wrote in a public comment in May, "While an important topic, sustainability is outside of the scope of the dietary guidelines." Jesse Silverman of the Center for Science and the Public Interest said, "Even though environmental advocates face an uphill battle, a lot has changed since the failed 2015 effort to incorporate sustainability." She added, "I think the public pressure to have concrete policies to address climate change has grown a lot in the years since then."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.